Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a quick language warning for this next segment. The book's title contains a word some listeners may be offended by. Holly Wilson grew up in Kansas. She now lives in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. She's an associate professor of creative writing at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And now she has released her debut novel. It's called Kitten Tits. It's named after the nickname of the 10-year-old protagonist, Molly. Set in 1992, Molly is one of the most distinct and intriguing protagonists you will ever come across. Holly describes the book as fierce, funny, sad, happy, and wild. It strikes me as a feminist version of J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. As former Beta guest Kevin Wilson says, this is a wildly funny and utterly convincing coming-of-age novel like nothing I've read before. You got that right, Kevin. Holly had never written fiction from the point of view of a child before writing her novel, but she nailed it.
I think the voice was easier for me to do a child. It's probably why I decided to do a novel using it, because it came naturally in a way that writing an adult character didn't. It was not forced at all. It's easy to write. Childhood is a period I can go back to easily. I can inhabit that. And even though I was an adult when I was writing it, I think adulthood is more difficult to inhabit in a way, like the interior, or also it's maybe more boring too.
But that's the thing everyone loves about the book, is just how unique this character Molly is. And I'm going to ask you a really cliched question, which I probably shouldn't ask, but I am curious about it. Molly, and your name is Holly. How much of Holly, you know, they rhyme. Is there any connection? Like, do you have anything in common with Molly?
That's a good question. My middle name is Jean. Mm. So there's Jeannie too. Yeah, I didn't consciously choose that name to sound like my own, to say, oh, this is me, because she's not me. But yeah, I definitely think I think in everything any writer writes, there's always going to be some part of them in every character, or at least the main characters. There's definitely something of me and Molly. There's me and Jeannie. There's maybe not even Jeannie really, but more DeMarcus for sure. Yeah, like Molly's very lonely. She's very somewhat isolated. She has a lot of time on her hands, and that existed in my childhood for sure. Now, in terms of our personalities and temperament, there's big differences, and there are some. I get really excited about things the way that Molly does. I get very enthusiastic, but I, as a child, much more introverted. I certainly have never in my life spoken like Molly. I didn't talk that way. But her interests, you know, the things that kind of, like where her thoughts go, to gross things, kind of horror kind of stuff, that was totally me for sure.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about how Molly's life changes when a 23-year-old ex-con named Jeannie comes to live with Molly? And you've mentioned Jeannie a few times, but yeah, tell us about when they meet and how that affects their lives.
Yeah, well, Molly is just sitting around, you know, waiting for something interesting to happen. She lives in, I sort of think of it as like a Quaker commune, an abandoned Quaker commune, with her father, who is sort of just stuck in grief and mourning and doesn't really pay a lot of attention to her. She's not really seen by anyone, including her father, including the elderly woman that runs the commune. She's well-intentioned, but she's busy with other things, right? And so Molly is just kind of left to herself, her own imagination, her own wanderings. So she just hangs out, and so she's bored. And so this 23-year-old woman shows up, who's an ex-con. She's on parole. So the Quaker commune is now going to sort of attempt to function as a kind of halfway house. And of course, I mean, if this were me, if I were any 10-year-old, I would be fascinated by anyone who just got out of prison. What did they do? You know, are they tough? What can they teach me? How can I use this to become cool? Will they be my friend? You know, will they go to the mall with me? that kind of thing. So of course she's looking for whatever attention she can get.
Yeah, very well said. After I finished reading your book, I spent some cognitive bandwidth trying to come up with the description. It kind of struck me, and that's a good thing. I mean that as a compliment. It kind of struck me as a feminist version of J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. Does that make any sense to you?
Oh, that makes total sense. And I take that as a great compliment. No, I think if I had to trace the book's lineage, that book is certainly father, grandfather. I don't know. It's for sure. And I know that people, readers have really turned on that book in recent years. And I don't understand it because I read it and I think this is amazing. This is a masterpiece. This is beautiful and nuanced and deep. But not all readers feel that way. So yeah. For sure. There were other books, too, that definitely influenced it. Mark Richard's work, especially he writes the best child narrators of anyone.
Right. Mm. I haven't read any of his. Now I'll have to read some.
Yeah.
I haven't read any of his work.
He has a novel named Fish Boy that it makes my book seem so tame.
Well, that's a huge yeah. Verb there, right there. Yeah, if it makes your book seem so tame. Yeah, I'll have to check that out for sure. One of my favorite parts of your book is when Molly visits her pen pal, Demarcus Nasius, in Chicago. Can you share with us what Molly learns from meeting up with him?
What she learns?
well, maybe that's what she discovers.
I don't know if she learns anything ever. So she has this pen pal, Demarcus, who she writes to. I think he writes her back one time ever in the novel's backstory. But she keeps writing to him because she's lonely. And, you know, she's like, well, I'm just going to keep writing this kid. Maybe one day he'll reply. So in a way, he almost is kind of like an imaginary friend to her. So she, plot stuff happens and she finds herself running away to Chicago to locate him, to find him in person. And so she goes to Bronzeville, where he lives, in one of the Robert Taylor homes. And she goes into the apartment, and the first thing she finds is an elderly white woman in an iron lung. And then beneath the mysterious white woman in an iron lung is Demarcus, and he's hiding out underneath the iron lung, and he's a ghost. This is why he doesn't write back, of course, because he's dead.
Demarcus has this uncanny ability to experience something called thought forms. I was very intrigued by this. What are thought forms?
Well, so Demarcus, I wouldn't say he experiences them. He identifies as one. He is a thought form. And I don't know quite what to make of this. So Demarcus is he's like the foil to Molly, of course. He's very intellectual. He's very high-minded. He takes things very seriously in the ways that Molly doesn't. And of course, there's no way Demarcus would ever believe in ghosts. That would be stupid. And so here he now finds himself a ghost. And so he won't acknowledge that. Instead, he calls himself a thought form, which I think is just his way of working around the fact that ghosts in this world are real. But I don't know. I think that's how I originally sort of thought of it when I wrote it. But maybe there's something to that. Like, there's a line at the end. I almost took it out because I thought maybe it was cheesy. There's a line at the end when he finally meets his mother, who's also a ghost. He meets his mother, and then he realizes that, well, if he's a thought form, she was the one who was thinking him the whole time, right? To be a thought form, someone has to think you, right, into existence. And I don't know, it's interesting to think about ghosts that way, right? How, you know, we think about people we've lost, and we almost allow them to haunt us that way, you know? I think it's a nice idea.
Yeah, very well said. Your book is filled with dream worlds, and I hear that you are a big David Lynch fan. I am too. Yeah. How did your love of his work influence your novel, or did it? It must have in some ways.
So you're right. It probably did. Sometimes I read something and I'm like, oh, this will help me. This is going to give me a way into the work. This is going to help me with this scene or with how to, where to enter the scene or exit the scene or whatever. So that definitely consciously happens. But it's a good question with Lynch, because I don't know. I feel, to me, it feels very different in tone than most of Lynch's stuff. And also, I don't feel with Lynch, I don't know, could there be a translation between like film and prose with Lynch? I don't know. To me, he's so visual and so auditory. I don't know how would that translate, right, to fiction? And his stuff is so, he's not interested in like a cohesive narrative. And I mean, you're right though. Like, I'm sure it's in there. I love him so much.
Mm-hmm, me too. And the only thing that I could think of that was somewhat Lynchian about your book was the fact that fire shows up a lot, fire, and made me think of Fire Walk with Me and things. So I thought maybe that's, yeah.
No, you're right. No, so that wasn't conscious, but you're right, because he does that thing like in Blue Velvet, there's the flame, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's flames in every Lynch thing. Good point. Yeah, maybe you're right.
Maybe. Once in a while. I got to be right. I can't be wrong all the time. But yeah. You have said that when you're driving, you're thinking about characters. And when you are mowing the lawn, you think about structures. So I have to ask, when you're mowing the lawn, are you also thinking about David Lynch's The Straight Story?
Oh my gosh. Good connection. Nope. Well, I'm not, because I don't have a riding mower.
Yeah, which was my next question.
It's a push.
I was going to say, are you driving a John Deere 110 lawn tractor like straight did, but no. Yeah. Well, and also a push is probably better, because it requires more effort and makes you think more. Does it give you more of a chance to think about structure? Like if you were riding a riding mower, like a John Deere or whatever, would you still be able to?
I think I would go into character mode, because I think driving is, I don't know why it's that way. I think, well, when I'm driving, I'm listening to music, and music is evoking character for, I don't know, whatever reason it does. It puts you in a mood, an interior space, I guess, and then that goes to character. But I think maybe with mowing, now that I think about it, you're thinking of like you're mowing, and you're mowing in lines, and you're making a form or a shape, right? Like, today I'm going to do a square, and I'm going to go all around the square, or today I'm just going to go back and forth in straight lines, right? So there's something sort of structural to that.
Yeah. Well, what do you want your readers to experience while they're reading your novel?
Joy, happiness. And it's funny, because I don't know that everyone does feel that, because it has a lot of heavy stuff in it. There's a lot of death, grief, all that. But I want it to be alive and happy. And I think it is. I don't know that everyone feels that way. Everyone comes at it, you know, with a different background and perspective. But it's intended that way. Molly is, I mean, like I said earlier, I don't know that she learns anything. Maybe she does, but she's alive. She's very alive. And I want the prose to be alive. I want it to have lots of energy. I want, when I read something like that, when I read a particular kind of prose that has a lot of energy and is like, it does that to me. I have this feeling of it's, okay, so like, you know, imagine the feeling of going into like a beautiful cathedral, right? And you have this sense of awe, and often it's peaceful, tranquil, but it's a beautiful feeling, right? So I have a similar feeling, but with a different energy when I read certain writers who have a lot of energy in their prose. It makes me happy, you know, it makes me just glad to be alive. And that's what the book, you know, the book is about, being alive, not just being dead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And as you said, the book is fierce, funny, sad, happy, and wild. That's a lot to cover in a book. And you nailed it with everything. So congratulations to you. Holly Wilson, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on your debut novel. I can't wait to read your next book.
Thank you.
Find out more about Holly Wilson and her debut novel at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Chris Stein, Ian Nathan, and Holly Wilson.
They have a lot of zany stuff on this program, don't you think?
Beta is available to follow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
But he's just a raggedy man.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
The little one is called Master. He's the brains.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
The Ayatollah of Rock and Roller!